Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Ambassador Robert Hunter, who was a U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and U.S. representative to the Western European Union. He was the principal architect of the new NATO, leading the North Atlantic Council in obtaining airstrike decisions that halted the Bosnian War. He was also director of West European Affairs and later director of Middle Eastern Affairs on the National Security Council during the Carter administration and a principal author of the Carter Doctrine for the Persian Gulf. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Hunter.
Good to be with you.
And what do you make of these divisions within NATO over the intervention in Libya, where the French and the British apparently calling for more vigorous action? And we know, of course, that the rebels in Libya have been dissatisfied with NATO's response so far and the extent to which they've helped them, both in terms of humanitarian issues and in terms of beating back Gaddafi.
Well, first thing, and if there's no division in NATO, then we're living in a different world. Nothing's happening. That happens a lot. This time, however, I'm a little more worried than usual on a couple of counts. Number one, this is the first time I ever remember something being done by NATO in which the United States has not been in the lead. We have, for good reason or ill, deliberately pushed the leadership off onto some other countries, in this case, Britain and France. And in fact, there's this weird thing happening in Washington here, in which people are talking about there is the United States, and then there is a thing called NATO, as though we don't even belong to it. So that I think, is the first problem, that people are beginning to wonder, where is America?
Well, is that to say, though, without America, NATO is feckless?
Well, it's to say that NATO is really first and foremost about the U.S. engagement with European security and playing as a default position the leadership role. Now, I can understand why the president wanted to take a step back, President Obama. One, there is no stomach, understandably, in the United States for yet a third war. Secondly, there is a real desire not to appear in the Arab world and in the Islamic world, which are similar, but they overlap, as somehow, once again, the United States coming in a heavy-handed way and supporting the wrong people. Having said that, I think it was still a mistake to step back because the president was and has been repositioning the United States, I think, very effectively, to use Mr. Obama's phrase for it, to get on the right side of history.
Well, to some extent, you could make the argument that history has passed us by in as much as we were sidelined in Egypt. It took us a while to figure out what to do. It seems like Tunisia caught us by surprise. We're conflicted over what to do in Bahrain. And there's many in the realpolitik community who think that maybe we should leave the Assad dictatorship in place because the chips fall, they may have geopolitical consequences for Israel and other states that we won't necessarily like.
Well, to be fair, everybody that I know of was caught unawares by what happened in Tunisia and the wildfire that spread from it. And the United States, under Obama's leadership, I think, did play what we call catch-up very effectively. In fact, he was well ahead of his advisors in the administration. Some of them, one of them, the Secretary of State, even said she thought that stability in Egypt was something that had to be preserved. I think she got brought up short on that by the president, who said, no, I think we can deal without Mr. Mubarak. Now, other places, we have not been terribly consistent. You mentioned Bahrain. North Africa, where Libya is, quite frankly, strategically, is not a terribly important part of the world. The oil is going to flow, and it's only about 2% of world supply anyway. But when you get to the Persian Gulf, where you do have Saudi Arabia, which has a lot of problem with its Shia population, and certainly wouldn't want to have the Shia majority in Bahrain with a chance of governance. You've got a war in Iraq. You've got the looming image of Iran just across the Persian Gulf there, and so I can understand the administration being a little goosey about supporting transformation in Bahrain. But I think I do believe, in terms of the flow of history, it leaned too far in the other direction and is risking spoiling the excellent work, I think, that the president led the administration to do over Egypt and Tunisia.
So what should the United States do? It seems to me that we're at a very interesting moment here where our traditional realpolitik, where we've acted according to our interests and not necessarily according to our ideals, may have been turned on its head, in as much as it would seem that acting according to our ideals may well be more in our national interest.
I'm never sure that that is a distinction that adds up to that should add up to a general rule. We are now seeing in the Arab world what's being called, and for want of another term, the Arab Spring. This is a revolutionary movement which is perhaps not as consequential as what happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of European communism 20 years ago, but it's certainly the most consequential thing that's happened in the Arab world since the immediate aftermath of World War I and when the Ottoman Empire fell apart. And the idea of siding with the process of change, the wind of change, as British Prime Minister Macmillan said about Africa in 1960, is something which is profoundly, in my judgment, in the American interest. We got it right in Tunisia and in Egypt, if it took us a while. We got it right to begin with in Libya, though it took us a while. And I think we're basically getting it right in Yemen, where I understand the U.S. government has told President Saleh he needs to leave sooner rather than later. He's passed his sell-by date. But over Bahrain, I think we've got it profoundly wrong. And also, I think we have been inadequate in trying to indicate to the Saudis that they can't continue with their obdurate approach to the world and to life and still succeed even in their own staying in power beyond some finite point that I wouldn't dare try to predict.
Again, I'm speaking with former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, Robert Hunter. When you say we finally got it right in Libya, that's not necessarily what's translated on the ground, though, surely. I mean, it looks like a stalemate. It looks like Gaddafi still has the financial resources. He's hiring mercenaries, and the rebel army is kind of a Mad Max army that nobody seems to be supporting in terms of boots on the ground. And there's this impression that NATO is simply not up to the task.
Well, I think the United States did get it right at the beginning by following the lead of the French and the British in endorsing a no-fly zone and in the UN resolution, which calls for the use of all means necessary in order to protect civilians. Unfortunately, a week and a half ago, we withdrew two of the most potent instruments of Western power about the time when we transferred the operational authority from a coalition run by us, Britain and France, onto NATO itself, by removing the C-130 gunships and the A-110 ground attack aircraft. I think that this has delayed significantly the effort to try to weaken the Gaddafi regime. There was a certain problem here right from the beginning, and certainly from the time that NATO took over, which is, are we collectively just trying to protect civilians or trying to create the circumstances for getting rid of Gaddafi, a goal the president has endorsed? They don't compute. My own view is that once you get into a battle like this, and the old phrase, if you wound a king, you better kill him, that NATO needs to persevere, certainly with air power, to do what it possibly can to get rid of Gaddafi.
Well, that may well be the subtext. It certainly is the only thing that makes any strategic sense, but it's not what the UN signed on to, and obviously the African Union is opposed to it, and much of the European and American left are also opposed to it.
I suspect if there was an effort by the United States and NATO, et cetera, to use a good deal more air power than they're doing now. And if that led to the departure of Gaddafi, it's one of those circumstances better to ask forgiveness rather than permission. I don't think a lot of people in the world are going to say, well, gee, that was unfair. Let's put Gaddafi back in place. The worst thing, in some ways, is to do it in the half-hearted way that's being done now. So what, even if you do everything that's in the UN resolution and nothing more, given that the objective itself was ill-defined, you just don't look very successful or very capable.
Well, Ambassador Hunter, this stalemate is the worst of all possible worlds. If you end up dividing a country and keeping a dictator in power with a weak kind of rump Libya in the West, in the East, I should say, certainly nobody wants that. And I'm just wondering at what point, the president, has he really washed his hands of this? I mean, he has this business of the clock ticking vis-a-vis declaring a war, and can he successfully say we're out of it now and he doesn't have to talk to the Congress?
Well, I really can't parse the sentences precisely in terms of what he feels he needs to do with the Congress now. But in some ways, the United States has indeed more or less washed its hands of this by withdrawing the American offensive aircraft. We still have a lot of assets there in terms of flying missions that are of support. But what I'm worried about is that not only will it transpire the way you just described, in a stalemate that just drags on and on, making everybody in the West look a little feckless, but also that America's reputation for leadership will take a very hard shot. So I think the United States has to look at this again and seriously consider getting back into the fray.
So what's your then take, since Ambassador Hunter, you're there in Washington, and I'm sure you're at least aware of the of this idea of the clash of personality between the interventionists and the so-called three women and the skeptics like Gates and the National Security Advisor, the notion that somehow Obama is somewhere caught in the middle, being pushed to and fro between these two forces. What you've just suggested would indicate to me that as a politician who's running for re-election, he doesn't want to look feckless and he doesn't want to have a disaster on his plate. So what do you think is going to motivate him if this washing his hands of this thing is going to come back to bite him?
Well, what I hope will happen is a kind of a basic review of all the elements of it, in which there are two, I think, that argue for a more engaged American role here. Number one is the president's basic instinct, in which he related all the way back to his Cairo speech of June 2 years ago about the United States and the role and its role with the Islamic world and getting on the right side of history. And secondly, fair or not, the inability of what the NATO military folks have been able to do to affect the situation is being brought home to a great extent to the United States. And people are questioning not only American leadership capacity and willingness, but also whether we are fully committed to those elements of the alliance which are engaged when you have this kind of fighting going on so close to alliance territory. I can see an American role which still preserves the president's proscription on putting ground troops in, but until such time as we see an exhaustion of the capacity doing something from the air, I don't think we reach that problem. And right now, I'm afraid we're kind of getting the worst of both worlds.
Well, Ambassador Hunter, having been a U.S. ambassador to NATO, there are a lot of critics of American empire who are suggesting that we are simply atrophying, where we still have thousands and thousands of troops still in Japan and in Europe. What are they? I mean, I don't know what the numbers are now. You probably have a better grasp on it than I do.
About 105,000.
What are they doing?
Well, let's start off with number one, which is the United States is fighting two major wars, one of which was thrust upon us in Afghanistan, in which we have more than 100,000 troops there, and the Allies have about 30,000, and also in Iraq, where we're going to have troops there at least through the end of this year and probably after that. Admittedly, that was something we did ourselves, but it's pretty hard to ask the American people to pony up yet again, especially because, to be direct about it, even though Britain and France have put a number of air assets up, the rest of the Allies, with one or two exceptions, really are taking even more of a backseat than is the United States. So I don't think we should feel ashamed of what we've already done, particularly given that our plate is pretty full.
But again, what is our 100,000? What did you say? How many troops do we have in Europe still?
It's about 105,000.
What are they doing?
Well, a lot of those are at sea, and they are blockading the Libyan coast, among other things, and stopping the traffic in terrorism that has gone through at times the Mediterranean. And an awful lot of those forces are actually home, that their homes are in Europe, but they spend most of their time in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It's not like they're just sitting around doing nothing. We have almost nobody over there who isn't directly engaged in things that have a very serious strategic purpose.
So you can't make the case that they're sort of sitting around facing an enemy that no longer exists, the Soviet Union?
Oh, no, that changed a decade ago. That's way out of date. Most people who are attached to basing arrangements in Europe actually aren't there. They may come and go, but they're off putting their lives on the line in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, can we return to the subject of Libya and the conflicts within the alliance, where the British and the French are calling for a more vigorous response to Gaddafi, who's still around, and the rebels have been driven back to their two redoubts in Benghazi and Misrata, which is under siege. What do you think is likely to happen here, given that, as you've expressed earlier, the stalemate is untenable?
Well, my own personal view is that unless Gaddafi loses, he wins. And there's the old line of Polonius's advice to Laertes from Hamlet, beware of getting into a quarrel, but once in, bear it that the opponent will beware of thee. I think we are at a point now, we in the West, of needing to see through militarily, to extent that we have to do it, the getting rid of Gaddafi, that anything short of that is going to be more of a long-term headache than the short-term price of doing it. Now, I would start off recommending that the United States do more as it was doing earlier in terms of the actual engagement and offensive military air actions. Whether that'll happen or not, I have no idea.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ambassador Robert Hunter.
Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Hunter, who was the United States Ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and the U.S. Representative to the Western European Union. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a grassroots organizer organizing a left-wing version of the dominant right-wing political machine.